Hey, hey, hey.
You're listening to the Fade to Fade Network.
All right.
We invite people
of all backgrounds
to share their stories,
their nuanced conversations,
and forward thinking,
and not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing.
But not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray. What is up, everybody? Today, we've got a very special guest on. Actually, she's a huge friend of the podcast. She's been around for a couple years with Fade to Gray. I got to meet her in person. We all did a couple years ago at the Bad Christian Conference. And she started her own podcast about a year ago. I think it's been about a year. Is that right, Kara?
Very close. Yeah, March.
Okay, cool. Yeah, called The Conquest of Bliss. All about, of course, finding happiness. I'll let her explain all about that here in a little bit. But this is a long time overdue. And Kara, we're so excited to finally have you on the Fade to Gray podcast to get your story and talk to you. And just to let people know who you are. Of course, most everyone in our community does. But anyway, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was going to say, bow, bow. What's happening?
That was like a club saying, you know, you're like, welcome, welcome, you know.
Unfair. Thank you for that brilliant introduction. I'm also super stoked. Like you said, this has been a long time coming, and I have been like, I know the etiquette is not to be like, yeah, when am I going to be on your podcast? But I've been sending it to you mentally for a long time.
Well, we finally picked passive up aggressive. On it. I think maybe our friendly psychic PK Langley helped us tune into that. So so anyways, we're definitely excited to have you on. And you know, as with every single guest that we have, we always like to start out with your story. And you know, we obviously know a little bit more about you than we're going to let on because, you know, not everyone knows
naturally
about you. But you know, being as detailed as you want to, tell us about your beginnings.
Oh gosh.
When were you hatched?
31 years ago in a small town in northern British Columbia, which is a province in BC, which is similar to a state. No, I'm just kidding. I know you guys know that.
Similar to a education. State, but just not as great, right? Okay, keep going.
No, actually, they're much greater in both size and awesomeness.
Perfect answer. I like that.
But so I was grown up. I was grown up in a small town in northern BC. I almost said California. Fuck, man. I'm sorry. Is it okay to cuss?
Oh, heck yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, heck yes, it is.
Well, actually, that's check that off the list. I was going to say, can we get the Canadian to cuss? So, yay.
That's right.
It's really not challenging. Honestly, we have do you guys remember? Oh, were you part of that conversation about fuck all? Oh, you know what? Doesn't matter. Born in Mackenzie, lived there till I was 14. So was raised in the church, school, like private school, Sunday school all the time, part of the youth group. I used to travel the province teaching the good word via skits and music. It was.
Yay.
How old were you when you're doing that, Kara?
Probably between 10 and 14. So not very old, because it was about 14. Well, between 12 and 14, then I started to rebel. I mean, started smoking pot when I was 12.
Oof.
And binge drinking, but I didn't do any real drugs until I was 14. I'm just going to go over it really quickly because I have no idea what's interesting and y'all can.
Okay. Well, hold on. So I'm still like, you were like basically street evangelizing at 12, between 12 and 14, right? while you were smoking
as part of
weed.
The group. Well, they didn't know I was smoking weed.
Well, what church organization were you a part of then?
It was a non-denominational church, but they were very, they had like evangelists and stuff come in. Like, I don't know if you know who Todd Bentley is.
Oh yeah.
He's that
dude that's having that huge revival down in Florida and fucking all those chicks and got caught.
That sounds true. So it was just part of the youth group and it was really all I knew at that point. And then of course, I always say, of course, when it's not an obvious thing, but when
it's
I was
obvious to you.
When yeah, exactly. Of course, when I was 10, they put me in public school. Of course, naturally, that's what they do, right? so they put me.
You were homeschooled up until that point.
No, I went to a private Christian school. So we used the ACE, the Christian accelerated Christian education little workbook things. Mm-hmm.
How many macaroni necklaces did you make?
Enough to feed an army. and then I went to public school, and this thing I think is of course they bullied me really, really badly. And so like I rebelled and everything, and then I started smoking pot because of course in BC there it is again. You notice it so much more when you start recording how much you repeat the same phrases. It's really frustrating.
Mine's obviously, but you just gotta keep talking. Don't worry about it. Let people scream at you later.
But fair. Yeah, so I went to public school, and then I got bullied, and marijuana became available, and then drinking became available. And so I started drinking and stuff. And then we ended up moving from McKenzie when I was 14. There was some really confusing, hard to explain even now, trauma that happened right before I moved. And then we moved, and then my parents sent me to Missouri, basically as a consequence of my reactions to this trauma, although of course they didn't see it that way at the time. And so they sent me to Missouri to live with these people that they met on the internet, actually. And in 2004, there was no video chat. So like, you know, just typing and stuff, which was really traumatic as well.
How old
and
then when you I then? Came at this point,
sorry?
How 14. Old are you at this point in the story?
Okay, 14. So
2 years into your drinking and your drugging, and yeah. your parents suggestion was, or solution, I guess, would be to send you to the States. Was that something else that was like a religious sort of answer? Is that what made them qualified to take a 14-year-old girl from Canada into their home?
Well, realistically, nothing made them qualified to do that. Now, Sheila, to be very clear, these are wonderful people, and it's very lucky that it didn't go badly.
Yeah. I mean, going to another country. I mean, how did your parents know these people?
They met on Pogo Games.
What? Pogo Games?
Okay, like I said,
wow.
Did they
people
lose
there are really, really wonderful. But, you know, my parents were just doing the best they could. I know that now.
Well, hold up just a second. Okay. All right. You're going 90 to nothing. Just a second. Okay, you're 14 and something traumatic happens. Mm-hmm. What was the trauma?
Sent away to America.
Okay.
She said something happened before that.
Okay, so before
if you're willing to share it.
I am. It's complicated and confusing, and but yes. So when I was 14, so like I said, I'd started drinking and stuff when I was 12, I was smoking pot. So my brother, who was also bullied really badly, decided to have a party while my parents were out of town, and my other brother was out of town, and he decided to have this party, but nobody actually liked him. So people really kind of abused that situation, right? As teenagers do. And there was this guy at the party, and I think he was 19, but he might've been 18. And he gave me a bunch of mushrooms and then took me back to his house. And I actually blacked out a lot of what happened. I don't really know, but my journal had said that he had forced me to have intercourse with him. Whether or not that's actually true, I can't say for sure. But following that, basically as it does when you're that age, it got out, and the town kind of split about whether or not that was accurate. And then the cops got involved in all of this stuff. And again, I'm 14, a virgin, and have no idea if that even happened. The only things that I remember is I remember him trying to get me to suck his dick. And I remember him not allowing me to leave. Now, to his credit, to be fair, maybe that was because I was a 14-year-old girl who's going to walk by herself, or maybe he was that guy. I don't really know. I don't really know.
Yeah. That must have been a really small town if it like split the town. I mean, people were talking about it like that. Jesus.
Yeah, it turned into a really big thing. And I ended up getting a bunch of death threats and stuff like that before I left. And again, I mean, at the time, I really didn't know how to handle it. But I don't know how I would handle that now. Right.
Yeah.
Like not even knowing what the truth is and not trying, like, because I didn't tell everyone. You know, I confided in a single friend. and it ended up spreading like wildfire as that kind of thing.
How long was it after the event that the cops actually got involved? Because it seems like it had to been a really small town if they didn't, or like
it was a couple of days, because it was once my family members got wind of the circumstances that I was forced to go talk to the cops, right? Because my adult family members caught wind of it and were like, yeah, no. But of course, and this is, I think, and of course, is that, you know, even if it were sexual assault 100%, which I can't really say, you like after 3 days, people have showered, they've washed their clothes, any sense of evidence that could have been there is gone.
Yeah.
Right. So that didn't lead anywhere. It just made the whole social situation much, much worse. And my parents they didn't know how to handle that. They weren't equipped to do that. Therapy wasn't what it is today, where, you know, people know to send children to therapy after trauma and stuff like that. So when we moved, I ended up getting involved in less stable people. You know, I didn't have any Christian types in my life. It was all people who wanted to party and who discouraged me from having a good relationship with my parents, if I'm being truthful. Now, the trauma and the way they reacted to it also escalated that situation.
Sure.
And my parents wanted to send me to boot camp, couldn't afford to send me to boot camp, and their alternative was to send me to Missouri. If you have any questions about that, I can elaborate.
Where is this boot camp they were wanting to send you to?
I don't know. I think just they looked at prices of boot camp. I don't really know.
So
again, I was 14.
They were on Pogo Games, and they're like, yep, this is the family I want to send my daughter to.
Well, how
I don't even know what Pogo Games is. I mean, it sounds like they lost like in a gambling like card game or something.
It's just like a gaming website that used to be really popular. They have Word Womp. It's really fun.
So let me get this straight, because I want to make sure that I'm being, you know, extremely sensitive to the subject. But you've got quite the conundrum here.
Yeah,
you've quite possibly been taken advantage of in a really horrible way, but you don't know for sure what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led, of course, to your parents wanting to send you to a boot camp. It's almost like, are they victim blaming here? What are they doing?
I think, so I've talked to my mom about this a lot, and I've talked to my dad about this a lot. And my dad has generally landed on, I was asking for it, even into adulthood, that's his belief. My mom's opinion has changed pretty dramatically, and basically she felt like she was between a rock and a hard place. It didn't occur to her that I was reacting out of trauma and freaking out and having, you know, because I mean, it's pretty scary when people are threatening your death and stuff for something, you know, like that. And so as far as my mom was concerned, I was just rebelling. She didn't understand that it was a reaction to everything that had been going on. You know, when 2 short years before, I'd been living the simple Christian life that had no access to any of this kind of stuff, right?
So were you being pretty rebellious against your parents at this time?
Yes and no. Like, I mean, I spent a lot of time with my brothers partying and stuff. So I wasn't rebelling more than my brothers in the sense of putting myself in danger or anything like that. But I was like giving my parents a lot of attitude. I was very angry with my parents for a lot of reasons, and some of them more valid than others, you know?
Yeah.
So what ended up happening is my parents felt that I'd gotten out of control. They weren't even factoring in what had happened.
Hmm. Yeah, that's rough.
Mm-hmm. So then how long were you in Missouri with this couple?
So it was a couple.
What did that look like?
It was a couple and 3 children.
Were they the Showalters?
They were not.
It's all coming together.
And they were a Christian couple, and they had 3 children. Bethany's close to my age, and we're actually really close. And what was the first part of the question?
How long were you there?
Right. Yeah. So I was there 3 to 4 months. Okay. I have a really hard time with specific dates, and I just really struggle with it. But I know I was there from early June until right before school started here, so around September. So I don't know have exact dates, but so they sent me, they told me the night before I was leaving that I was going, so I didn't, you know, have time to run away or whatever. And what it looked like was like, well, it's really interesting because when I remember the experience versus when I try to like look at it, what it actually was, they're two very different things. like remembering the experience was very, very like sad and angry and like, this is garbage and I don't have anybody. And that's where I started smoking cigarettes, was in Missouri, because like I couldn't get a hold of pot or cigars or anything, but the family smoked. So I would steal their cigarettes and go on these long walks down these like ridiculous, what in my brain are really like long dusty roads, but I don't really know if it actually even looks like that or how much of it was like influenced by the feelings that I was having. Yeah. But when I look back now, like they were so welcoming, they were so kind. They bought Kraft dinner because they heard Canadians like Kraft dinner, you know, stuff like that.
Is it like macaroni and cheese?
Yeah. Yeah. I do not like Kraft dinner. I like real macaroni and cheese, but
oh, gotcha. Okay.
But we are all raised on Kraft dinner. So,
maple syrup,
you were
right?
There for 3 months. Did Kraft you like, maple syrup. Oh, sorry.
No, I just had a maple syrup joke. That's all.
I live for maple syrup.
Naturally.
The thing about the 3 months though, that I forgot to add, that made it especially interesting, was that when my parents sent me, they didn't have the money to bring me back. And they kept telling me that they didn't know when they would be able to bring me back. So those 3 months felt like infinity, because it wasn't like you'll be coming home for school. They were talking about putting me in school in Missouri and all this stuff. So just worth noting.
Yeah. And so during your time in Missouri, did you, I guess, have any sort of cathartic experiences that made you want to go home and behave?
Quite the opposite. Yeah. my time in Missouri made me extremely bitter.
Sure.
And extremely, like pretty easy to see for me that that's where my abandonment issues really started. And my time in Missouri, like if anything, it was like anti-progress, because it hardened me and it made me want to be a bitch and push everyone away. And especially my parents, like it took a very long time to heal the relationship with my mom. And like, I mean, I remember doing some really stupid stuff in Missouri, but I didn't learn anything from it. When I came back was when I started doing MDMA and ecstasy and harder drugs, which eventually, as you guys know, led me to smoking crack. Right. So.
Well, let's get into that then. I mean, I know it's the dark time in your life and you probably, you know, have blackout memories, you know, where you can't really figure what happened out. But like, how long were you involved in those types of drugs?
Like crack?
Yeah.
Or cocaine or both?
Yeah.
Okay. So Omar, you look like you want to say something.
No, I was just debating. Oh. We have a lot of listeners in Missouri, so I was going to keep all my jokes to myself.
I was going to say, how bad could...
There are some easy jokes here, but... and thank you so much for being...
She's from Canada, and you know how rebellious could she have been? Like, Mom, you're such a bitch. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I apologize for everything.
Hey. But no, thank you so much for far being vulnerable. I know we're going to get into some more stuff, talk about, you know, the drug use and addiction and stuff like that. But I'm learning things about your story that I didn't know too. And just thank you for sharing. It's anytime someone's talking about, you know, being 14 years old and in that situation, I mean, you're a victim no matter what happened. I mean, everything you're describing, like it's none of that is your fault. So that's and to have, you know, to this day, your dad still, you know, holding that stance. It's just, having three daughters, it blows my mind, like how any man could say that to you. So that's ridiculous.
Well, thank you for your very kind words. Yeah, my dad and I have he's a unique man. To the comment about victimhood, so I agree that I
hang on, is that the Canadian way of saying your dad's an asshole?
It may be.
Okay, keep going. I was just interpreting that.
To the comment on victimhood, what's really interesting that I've been thinking about lately especially is that, like, I agree that I was the victim of those situations, but I, you know, and I know you guys know this because I know how y'all roll, but it's so interesting that like I finally was able to put to words that like you can be a victim situationally without identifying as a victim, you know, as a part of like as part of your identity. And anyways, thought that was interesting. But yeah, and I mean, honestly, I agree with you, you know, none of this is my fault and any of it is other people's faults too. They can't change if they want to. So, you know,
yeah,
what you gonna do?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be necessarily a defining moment, but it's still something that, that happens, you know what I mean?
So, mm-hmm.
And it seems like the things afterwards were more defining anyway, as you're telling the story. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it's still trauma. It's a trauma, but it's like a continuation of trauma, the way like things just piled on to all of a sudden you're getting shipped off to misery. So where nobody comes back to the same.
I really related to that Maroon 5 song, like the I Live in Misery. But anyways, I got off track.
No, I'm that's not, okay.
So you came home. We were asking you about your progression into drugs then, because I'm sure like you went from coming home to Missouri and then you didn't all of a sudden start doing cocaine. There was progression there.
Very so, rapid progression, but yeah. So
oh, okay, talk us through the progression.
Well, basically, so like I came back and it was like very, very end of the summer, right before school started, like I said, and we all decided that we wanted to try ecstasy, which was not, it's not MDMA. It's like this shit press of random drugs with a highlight of MDMA, but
smack basically.
Pardon?
It's smack basically, speed. A lot of,
well, like, some of it's, yeah, some of it's speed. It's, see, and it's a little bit different, I think, on the West Coast than the East Coast. Cause I had this conversation with some of my friends in Montreal when I was in rehab about, you know, speed versus meth and the names of drugs in different places. But basically this is a pressed pill that is, it's got MDMA in it for sure. It's a very similar euphoric thing. And then it's got whatever other cheap drugs to fill it. And then it's pressed into a colored cap.
Yeah.
If you guys call that smack.
Well, I mean, that's, that. Yeah. I mean, the combination of whatever they're mixing it with the MDMA, but yeah.
Yeah. So we eventually, we started doing it. And then eventually a couple friends and I, one of them got cocaine and they're like, we want to try cocaine. And this is when I say eventually, I mean like a couple months probably.
So you're 15?
Yeah, I would have been about 15. So I was 14 when I started doing MDMA, right when I got back. Turned 15 in October. And in October was when I started, like, or maybe November, like in that time frame was when I tried cocaine. And once I tried it, I started using it more and more all the time, mostly weekends and stuff. I was working lots of different jobs, but I think 3 jobs at one point, but I don't know if that was during the cocaine or the crack. And then I first tried crack when I was 16, but didn't get into it. And then later,
I don't guess I know the difference between cocaine and crack.
Oh, I can tell you the difference between cocaine and crack. okay. So cocaine is a product of the coca plant. So it's extracted and refined into cocaine, which is a powder that you can snort. You can technically eat. You can mix it with, I don't know what you mix it with, but you can inject it. Or you can technically smoke it, but it's not really a smoking drug. Like, you're not really going to get the, I don't want to say benefits because that's not really the right word.
The full effect.
Effects. the same way when you're smoking it. Whereas crack is, you can technically, like, you can't really snort crack. Like, I wouldn't snort crack. So what crack is it's cocaine mixed with either ammonia or shit. Baking powder. Yeah.
Soda. one of those.
and it turns it into like a rock form, and it is smokable at that point. And usually people smoke crack. Occasionally people will inject crack, but usually you would smoke crack and you use like a tube. And I don't know how much you know about concentrates for marijuana, but it's kind of similar to shatter in that you would melt it in order, like, you know, with shatter, you need, if you're using like a bong or something, you need like ash or something to hold it. Same thing with crack. It'll just turn into a liquid as you smoke it. So you need something to hold it. So that's why they use Brillo, which is like that metal webby stuff. And they shove that into the tube. And then that way, as it runs down, it still stays enough so that you can get the whole hit when you smoke it.
I had to go check on the kids and came back and we're doing a crack tutorial.
Chris needed to learn about crack.
I didn't know the difference between crack and cocaine, and so she's just helping me out there. So bacon different types of high.
The main difference.
Yeah, well, you can use ammonia too if you're freebasing.
Yeah.
Great. but I haven't done that in a long time. I feel so awkward. Look how red my face is.
Oh, you're fine. It's okay. It's okay. Keep going. We found your one weird thing for the episode. Keep going.
Give you detailed descriptions of crack. And then, yeah, so when I was a little bit later into being 16, my uncle actually was living in our house, and he was smoking crack, and he offered me to smoke some. And of course, there's that whole authority thing and wanting to, and he was my favorite uncle growing up, and he's dead now. And I've talked to my mom about it before, and she's cool with me talking about it publicly. It's her brother. but yeah, so my uncle offered me some crack, and he's like, "Hey, Carol, want a hoot?" I remember very specifically. He was standing right outside the thing, and I was like, "Oh, okay." And then he would offer it to me regularly, and before I knew it, I was smoking crack every day. And I think the reason that he wanted to get me in on it with him was because it was cheaper, and also ultimately I found out that he was lusting after me.
Oh my God.
Yay.
Yeah, fun times. I do not like my teenage years very much. So that's the story of me smoking crack. And then when I was 18, or maybe late 17, so I wasn't even on it for that long, but I was pretty addicted. I was like looking on the floor for rocks and stuff, like pretty severely into it. Although nobody knew, everyone thought I was just a cokehead, except for my uncle. And then, yeah, so when I was late 17, early 18, I went to my drug and alcohol counselor, and I said, I need to go to rehab, and I need it to be far away, because every time I'd gone to try to a detox or anything like that locally, I would just manipulate my mom into coming and picking me up. And, you know, because my mom, you know, felt really guilty for a lot of the shit that I'd been through. And so she would come and pick me up every time. And I was like, I need to get away from the opportunity to be enabled. And so I spent, you know, 6 months still using, getting into the program in Montreal. And I smoked crack right before I got on the plane to Montreal. And that was the last time I've smoked crack. That was 13 years ago in a couple months.
Yeah. Wow.
Did your uncle ever
apologize
or make a pass at you to
very different questions.
I was thinking more along the lines, did he ever act on
tried, yeah. He asked me to have sex with him.
And you were able to, but I said no and I just left.
I mean I'm grateful that when he tried, he wasn't aggressive about it. He was trying the whole manipulation side of things and not the threatening authority figure side of things. And I'm grateful, because I definitely, especially as a teenager, was very, very susceptible to the idea of authority. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful that he didn't take that approach, and that, I mean, it's still right. Skeezy as fuck.
Yeah.
Right.
But at least I didn't feel like I had to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important. Did your mom know about all of that when he was doing that?
Not until he died. No, I didn't tell her. Oh. I didn't tell her about any of that, because I would have had to tell her that I was smoking crack, and then I would have had to, like, because he tried to get clean, and then he eventually did get clean. He was clean for about, I don't know, 6 months before they diagnosed him with the lung cancer, and then within like six months, it metastasized to his brain, and he was dead.
Wow.
Wow. So. Yeah, pretty wild.
So when by the time you went to rehab in Montreal, had your uncle died at that point then?
No, he actually only died, only like 6 or 7 years ago.
I understand that. Only I was thinking about that the other day with some people in my life who died. Like, yeah, it was last year. Nope, it was like 6 years ago.
Yeah, that's so wild how quickly, like, the time passes.
Time flies, yeah. So in Montreal, what was the name of your recovery program?
It was called Portage. which means to carry a canoe over land.
Ooh, it was French.
Rivers. Yes. So, well, I was in an English program. It was in West Island, Montreal. So Beaconsfield specifically. But the program as a whole was a lot in French Canada. There was another one in Montreal for adults and then another one in Quebec, Quebec City. And then I think another one in Nova Scotia, maybe. But that one I think was probably English speaking. Yeah, Nova Scotia is beautiful, but there's no work there. But the houses are so cheap. Not that I ever think about that. but and the program was not 12-step based, interestingly enough. It was based on like military style principles.
So not faith-based at all either.
No. We did say the Serenity Prayer, but it was not faith-based at all. They didn't talk about our faith. I mean, we could have gone to religious services or whatever if we'd wanted to. There's a lot of Jewish people there, like a lot of Jewish people. I met more Jewish people there than I have in the rest of my life combined.
Wow.
Yeah.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So
yours was specifically for teenagers.
So it was, I think 13 to 18.
Okay. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say you were how old? 16, 17 when you went?
No, it took about 6 months for me to get in. So I went when I was 18, just gotcha. Turned. It was November 21st. And then I returned on September 25th. So it was 9 months.
Wow.
I was only there while I was 18.
Yeah. And what was the program like? I know you said it was like militaristic, but like, what did they have you do?
Okay. I'll try and give a quick, there's so much to it. It's like trying to describe like how does Harry Potter work really quickly, but like it's a whole different world. But so you go, when you first start, first 3 days, you can smoke as many cigarettes as you want. And you can just wander around. After the 3 days, you become a new member. And as a new member, you don't really have any rights, any of very few responsibilities. And then you move into a medium member. I don't remember the name of it, where you get responsibilities like wrap and ramrod. So ramrod would take care of the kitchen and cooking, and wrap would take care of what everything gets cleaned. And then you become an older member. And then you become part of like the leadership team, and then eventually chief, which means that you're in charge of everyone there. And the only person with more authority than you is the staff. And then you leave. But the way that the day-to-day works is you wake up, you have to clean your particular area. So your bed has to be made with military corners, like bounce a quarter off of it kind of thing. Your clothes have to be folded a specific way and everything has to be perfect. And then we clean the dorm areas, and then we clean the whole building. No, wait, sorry. Then we have breakfast, and then we clean the whole building. And then you have either meetings or school, and then you would have lunch, clean the whole building again, meetings and or school again, dinner, clean the whole building again. And so this is like a giant ass building. And then there's meetings in school and a combination of those. And then once a week we could go to the gym. Once a week we had outdoor activities. There was no music except on weekends. I couldn't wear my hair down. I couldn't wear makeup. I couldn't wear a tight shirt and tight pants. I had to pick. These are just the things,
really odd.
Things that I can remember off the top of my head. Oh, 4 cigarettes a day if you smoked. Wow. And some of them, like, it was on like a time crunch, so if you didn't clean up fast enough, you'd only be given like 2 minutes to smoke your cigarette, that kind of thing.
Seems like they're doing kind of like an idle hands approach. Like if you have free time, you're going to want to, you know, get a fix or something. So let's just fill up your entire day to where you're not really thinking about it.
I think that that's part of it. And I think that it also had to do with the fact that most of us that landed there were not taught life skills by our parents. So learning things like how to properly clean, learning how to delegate tasks to other people when you're in a position of authority, all of these types of life skills that allow you to like work in the real world and stuff like that. I think that that was the big reason that they went that way.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, you went through rehab. You're done with that. Did it sober you up right away? Did it work?
That would depend on who you talk to. So I didn't do absolutely anything for the full year. So it was a year clean off of pot and everything but cigarettes. Alcohol. I mean, my 19th birthday. So 19 is like 21 there. It's the age of drinking, legal drinking age. And my 19th birthday, we made a bustier pinata and had absolutely no alcohol whatsoever, which is unheard of in my culture and stuff. And then about a year and a couple months in, I started smoking pot again. It was quite a while before I did anything harder than that again, probably another good year before I did mushrooms again, even. And I know that I just said hard as if mushrooms are fucking hard, but you know what I mean? and then, eventually, you know, I started learning more about drugs as like a function of like being a tool, you know, and just like a hammer can kill someone or it can build a house. A drug can hurt you or it can help you to learn, right? And it's about responsible use, right? I mean, I'm a big believer that they should legalize all drugs, but that's a whole other thing.
We might need to go down that road, but keep going.
And at this point, I will, you know, if the situation's right and you know, I'm prepared for it emotionally and everything, I will do MDMA or acid or mushrooms, smoke weed or drink. But other than that, I don't really have any interest in any other drugs. And I haven't done cocaine or crack in over 13 years.
Good. Yeah. Well, that's one thing that, you know, Omar and I have talked about quite a bit, about the fact that we think that, you know, drugs should be legalized. But how do you, as someone who was addicted to doing crack or whatever, how do you reconcile that? Like, don't you think that that would make it easier for kids to get a hold of it or not? I want to hear from someone who's actually, you know, experienced hard drugs like that. You know, I agree with you. I think if you legalize it and make it, you know, more a medical thing as opposed to a punitive jail time thing, you're going to, you know, really help people out. But like, as someone who has been addicted to that stuff, how is making it more accessible? How does that better?
Ooh, I have so many thoughts. Okay. So one thing before we get started that's worth noting when we have this conversation is I am not a libertarian in the same way that you are, or were. Maybe you're not anymore. I don't know. But I'm a fucking socialist. Okay. So it's worth noting that when I talk about this, because I think that if we take away the black market and spend the money that we've been spending fighting the black market on education, we're going to have a lot less issues with that. I also think that alcohol is less accessible to children than marijuana is, because marijuana is available on the black market and alcohol generally isn't, right? So if we have stores or places like pharmacies, basically recreational pharmacies or whatever, where you can get this and it has an age limit, it's actually less accessible to children than it is if it's available on the black market, right? Because responsible parents are going to put that stuff away where their kids can't access it, or they're going to do their best. I know mistakes happen, but they're going to do their best. And the irresponsible parents would probably be a place for their kids to get it anyways. Like if it's going to be in the house, and like that legalization doesn't change how responsible the parent is with the handling of it. But by it being on the black market, it's way more accessible to children, because the drug dealers are not responsible to take IDs in the same way that, like, say, a liquor store is. Mm-hmm. So, and I also think, like I said, a lot of that money that they use to fight black market drugs and to fight addictions and stuff like that, if that was funneled into educating children on, say, you know, the side effects of drugs, as well as what their potential medicinal uses are, I think that would go a long way in stopping children from using drugs. Because one of the reasons that I ended up using drugs is because I did it and felt like my parents lied to me by telling them they were bad when I had so much fun. And I was like, obviously this isn't bad. And obviously you guys are fucking liars if you said that it's bad all the time.
Right. But
I ranted. I got excited.
No, you're good. You're good.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
I think it's a good perspective.
Did you all have in Canada, like, for example, here in the States, we had this program called DARE. Did you all have anything like that?
Drug abuse resistance education.
Yeah.
Yes, it did not help.
No, it didn't. And they pumped millions of dollars into that, you know?
Yeah, and that's just it, is that, like, educating children on like reefer madness style propaganda about drugs is not going to fucking help, because children are not as stupid as we like to pretend they are.
They're really not.
But you would take the same stance on all drugs too then, and not just say the recreational drugs like marijuana or mushrooms, where some of the states in out west have kind of like opened up some of those doors, but you're talking about even more of a deep dive into like what government fund heroin dens, like how does that work out?
Okay, so first of all, I'm not a politician, and that's probably good for everyone, but I actually do think that it should be, oh, there is water in there. Oh, sorry. I actually do think that it should be all drugs, because I think the priority for me is eliminating the black market. And I also think it's worth noting that heroin, cocaine, all of those drugs have medicinal uses, and they were discovered and originally used medicinally. And so, yeah, I think that it should be made available, but I think that there should be a limit. I think that, you know, you go in and say it's heroin. Well, you can buy 1 point or whatever of heroin per day, you know, and just like the pharmacies have a system with how much you've withdrawn, you would use that system so that people, if they really want to abuse it, they can, but it's not easy to abuse.
Do you think that that would kind of exacerbate itself, kind of like the opioid crisis has here? Do you think people would, maybe doctors would start prescribing heroin to people, and then they would get hooked on that?
Well, doctors are already doing that. They're just doing it with ones that aren't considered Schedule One.
Right.
Yeah. So like, I don't think that it's gonna, if anything, I think that it'll be safer, because like the opioid crisis, I've lost, I've seen a map, probably a dozen, maybe more people in the last 5 years to fentanyl overdoses. Yeah. Now, some of them, well, you know, I used to use a lot of drugs, so it's not really that. but the some of them were intentionally using fentanyl, but the vast majority of them, it was drugs that were cut, you know, whereas if they're regulated, if stores are made to, and I know, like, I know that regulation is common here. So to me, it doesn't seem scary. And I know that the government is a little bit more sketch in other places, and you don't necessarily trust them. But if they have systems in place where it needs to be X amount of purity in order to keep your license, I think that that would actually make the opioid crisis a lot less bad.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with you on governments being less sketch in Canada. I mean, didn't Trudeau get caught doing blackface like 5 or 10 times?
Well, number one, yes, and I don't like Trudeau. as a rule, I don't like Trudeau. He's done like 2 good things. When I say the government is less sketch, first of all, I'm not trying to say that Canada's government is without its problems. It's not. But what I mean is that there is a lot of systems within the systems meant to protect the people. And the government of Canada, above almost anything else, protects autonomy, right? Like, it was the very last resort, and they didn't even do it everywhere, to make people wear masks. You know, we're allowed to prostitute. You're just not allowed to buy it. I'm allowed to be high on anything, and I can't be arrested for it unless I'm operating machinery. You know,
Wait a minute. You can prostitute, but the person that's buying it's the one that's going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. So I could sell my body, but the person who's, if they get caught, right? And I can't advertise it, but ultimately at the end of the day, the government is protecting the bodily autonomy of its citizens above everything else. And then, like I said, we have these fail safes, and they don't always work, and corruption is still very much a thing in Canada.
Sure.
But the system is built for the people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I find it interesting. I do agree that drugs should be legalized, for the simple reason that, you know, you don't give someone who's sick prison time, you give them a doctor. And I feel like people who are addicted to crack cocaine or whatever you want to call it, that term is probably not even a real term.
Crack cocaine is a term, yeah.
Okay, good. They would do better in rehab than they would be in a jail,
so
where they now have a felony where they can't get a good job. And they also now have all these penalties that they have to pay. You know, they're never going to get back on their feet again, most likely. Or if they do, it's going to take a while, you know, unless, of course, you're Joe Biden's son. But anyway, I want to hear more about your podcast, The Conquest of Bliss. Let's talk a little bit about that. What is the purpose? I mean, the name kind of says it all, but what is the purpose of your podcast, The Conquest of Bliss?
You know, this is going to sound silly. Sorry. Omar, I couldn't hear
you're
you.
You're muted.
That was just the most Canadian thing you've said yet. Don't you know?
Don't you know? No, that's more.
Don't you know.
Wisconsin.
I really like my podcast, eh? That's more.
There it is. There it is.
It's such a funny thing because, like, I feel like my relationship to my podcast is weird. I try really hard not to define too much or put too much pressure on what it should be. I try to let it have its own flow. But I think, like, ultimately what I'm doing is I'm exploring the concepts behind happiness, exploring psychological tools that have helped me and other people to get out of, you know, like, you know, I just kind of told parts of my story and, you know, that's not even all of the stuff. And yet I'm one of the happiest people I know. And it's like, why is that? And how can I help other people to find that too? And I never know what information is relevant. Like, we never do, right? We never know what it is that we're doing right. So I figure talk to as many people as I can about as many topics that loosely or specifically fit happiness, and hopefully people can pick up pieces that will create that happiness for themselves, or at least find it, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I was on your podcast episode 5, best episode you got, and I loved the concept. You know, let's just talk about, you know, what you're passionate about, I suppose, and that's what we did. And of course, I'm passionate about language as a language teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of got into some deep stuff with how language does affect happiness, or if it doesn't, you know, and how it, you know, changes your perspective on things. Different words in different cultures, you know, have different Absolutely. Strengths and whatnot. And so I really appreciated my time on your podcast. It was a really good time, actually. So, and I really yeah. appreciate you having me on.
I no problem. I so enjoy that
it
too.
In right now, that's all.
I so I do so bad with razzing. It's one of my favorite episodes too, and unfortunately, it's one of the episodes that I edited, which means that the sound is garbage. and I've been meaning to get out that old computer that I did it on and ask Caldy really, really nicely if he wants to edit some old episodes, because I really enjoyed that too. And I think that, you know, like, that's the thing, is something like language, people don't think about that as being related to happiness. You know, I don't know if the right word is take for granted the number of factors that play into our sense of well-being and our sense of joy. And it can be something tiny. And, you know, we're kind of trained in this world to dismiss, you know, and to not analyze, and don't be an overthinker, and don't be, you know, don't be so obsessive and stuff like that. Well, fuck that. I mean, if it's something that makes your life better, then be obsessive, you know, try and find the answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's a great podcast, and certainly we're hoping that everybody that's listening right now, if they haven't already checked it out, that they would go and give it a try. I think it's fantastic, for sure. And definitely start out with episode 5. I mean,
and for what it's worth, I've been wanting to ask Omar on and just haven't yet. And now I feel awkward about it because he razzed me about it. And now
no, I was like giving, Chris shit because he was rubbing it in. He just kept going on and on and on about how he got to be on your episode. I was like, sure, Chris, she likes you better. That's fine.
We have a question from one of our former cast members, I guess. Andy Gillis is asking, Kara, how do you recommend getting off the hamster wheel of negativity?
Ooh, that's a great question. Also, hi, Andy. I've been thinking about you and I've been wondering where you are. So
we have too.
Yeah.
We have a t-shirt design that's Where's Andy? Looks like Waldo.
But that's a really good question. And I think that the answer varies for every person. But one of the ways that I would recommend to start is if you're someone who uses social media a lot, and I'm including Reddit and some of the more obscure anonymous social medias.
Parler for Andy.
whatever, I thought that was shut down.
whatever social media you use or whatever news media you consume, is pepper in some things that interest you, remind you of the light in the world. So if you're someone who's really into octopi, you know, follow some octopus subreddits or some pages on Facebook, and pepper it in slowly so it doesn't feel overwhelming. And before you know it, you know, your preferences change to that, and you're seeing a lot more light in the world. And that, you know, you're not gonna, like, there's always gonna be negative in the world, and it does no one any favors, and it fixes nothing by putting your energy there. So just find ways to subtly bring your attention to the positive things, and that gives you the energy to actually make positive change.
I think that's a really cool suggestion, actually.
Yeah. That's different than what I've heard, but I really like that. I think that's kind of what I've been doing for myself, and in an attempt to not be so depressed. It's not working very well, because you can ask Omar, I'm having some freak out moments, but.
Well, and I mean, that's okay. I mean,
I think everyone's freaking out in 2021, man, or trying not to. It just feels like everybody's a little bit more on edge this, you know, more so than not.
Well, and for some unsolicited advice that is unsolicited.
Go for it.
I would say the biggest thing is to be kind to yourself and remember that shitty things, while shitty, are something that you ride out. And it's okay to feel shitty. It's okay to be, you know, the worst, not the worst, the most harmful thing that you're going to do when you feel shitty is to constantly deride yourself for it and tell yourself, I can't even be happy. I'm such a piece of shit. You know, my kids don't even get to see me happy, blah, blah, blah. The whole intrusive thoughts bullshit is just go, you know what? Those are thoughts that my brain has been trained to think, and that's okay. But really, I want to be kind to myself, you know, for everyone's sake.
That's good. That's really good. And I think,
and that, so you have like 4 master degrees to get to that point, right? Sorry, go ahead, Omar.
No,
sorry, I wasn't trying to be like over.
No, I think it's awesome.
I think that's great advice. I was just gonna say, with a message like that, I mean, I definitely want to funnel people towards your podcast. And as you're describing, kind of just the feel of what you do, and not really wanting to be boxed into a certain, like, well, this is like, you know, put like walls up around like who you are. It's, I think we understand that at Fade to Gray because it's more of a conversational type podcast. It's something where you're allowing the story to kind of create its own path or its own way. And so I love what you're doing, and have very sound advice, you know, as far as just loving yourself. And I think everybody is on some sort of conquest of bliss, whether they know it or not. So
Omar is just trying to butter you up to get on your podcast. You should have him on to talk marijuana.
I really appreciate it. And actually, I just recently had someone on to talk about psychedelic assisted therapy, who's in university for related subjects.
Is it like microdosing?
We'll find microdosing or macro dosing. But specifically we were talking about acid and mushrooms and stuff, as well as marijuana. Her boyfriend goes to school for cannabis studies, which I didn't know was a thing.
Neither. That's
kind of
cool.
So in Mexico, so you know.
For the cartel.
I really do want to have Omar and Elizabeth, if she wants to, on. I've never had
her
before. I don't know why I'm saying this publicly, sorry guys, but when it comes to subject, if there's a subject you're passionate about, that's awesome. And as I always tell my guests, if there's not, the conversation always finds itself. So
yeah, well, I love it. And everyone, where can they find you? Like, obviously you're on social media. Do you want to tell them like how to get a hold of you, or is that private?
Very private. I don't actually want anyone to ever find me. No, I'm like super, like, I will add you and I won't delete you until you creep in my DM. So
note to yourself.
So I'm Kara Fernstrom on Facebook. I am the Conquest of B1 on Twitter, because I don't know how to Twitter. I am probably the Conquest of Bliss on Instagram. And I'm the Conquest of Bliss on Facebook as well, if you're just looking to follow the podcast and not my wholesome meme feed. It's theconquestofbliss@gmail.com. And if you want to find some stuff on my website, it's artstromdigitalmedia.com. Artstrom, artstrom, digitalmedia.com. Please, I shouldn't say that. If you wanted to ask me for commissions, you could, but I might not take them because I'm like really not sure what I'm doing with the whole art thing. So it was like, maybe just pay attention to the podcast.
Or become a Patreon.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, and I have a Patreon. Duh. Shit, I'm so bad at this. So on Patreon is the Conquest of Bliss.
Hey, how do you feel about Seth taking a hookup with some dude on Grindr instead of being here tonight?
I feel like if that's what he needs to do, that's what he needs to do.
I'm kidding. That's not what happened.
Maybe he's touch starved.
We love Seth. In fact, give him love. His cat just passed away yesterday. Oh, yeah. Too, so he's
that's true. I'm so sorry about Manelli. And I also love Seth. And
yeah,
I was hoping he'd be here as well, but you know, that's also a little greedy. So
he's watching, I think. I think he's watching.
Anyway, yeah, it's been great. I mean, learned so much, you know. Now we all know how to do crack or don't do crack, you know.
Yeah, and, I didn't give explicit instructions. I did give explicit really did. Instructions got, on yeah, talking crack.
Pretty detailed there.
You did.
And
I did learn a little bit about that, and I used to work at a drug and alcohol rehab center, so I thought I heard it all.
Oh, my face goes so red.
But it was right. A great conversation. Thanks for your openness. Thanks for your honesty. A lot of fun. Check out Conquest List. You say artstrom.com and
artstromdigital.com. Oh, it's not Artstrom Digital Media. I gave the wrong fucking address. Artstromdigital.com.
We'll make sure it's in the show notes. They'll get it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We're off live, I think. Did I end it?
You did.
Yep. You okay, did. Good. Well done.
Good job, guys.
Sport. Thank you, guys.
I checked on the kids a couple of times. The first time I checked on the kids, I came back and I'm like, wow, this is a detailed description of smoking crack. I don't know what just happened here. Like,
I leave for 1 minute.
I was just curious. I don't, you know.
I thought the difference I was between expecting fair, like, maybe fair. Like some like names and like numbers. Like, yeah, you go ahead, hit up my homie Butterfly.
Oh man,
prices, you know.
Well, I get really excited when I can teach people about things.
Yeah, no, this is fantastic, Kara. Thank you very much for your time and for coming on. Obviously, it's like I said, long overdue. So we're
yeah.
So well, I hope around. Nothing shocked you guys too much. I feel like most of that is stuff you guys knew.
Yeah, no, I don't. I wasn't shocked. Yeah. I was enthralled with the conversation, but I wasn't shocked.
Yeah, no.
I was shocked Elizabeth was asking more details about the Uncle Fucker.
I was actually super stoked that Elizabeth was talking.
She did a lot of talking in this episode.
Yeah.
Yes. Congratulations.
Great.
Thanks.
Well, I'm very glad that Elizabeth was on here too, because you've got really pretty eyes and you look up and you look like a deer and it makes me feel more comfortable.
Aw.
Thank you. My aunt called them ET eyes, so ET a deer is better than ET, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, deers are so cute. Yeah. They're like, you know? Or like a Disney princess. Like if you use the Snapchat filter, it probably wouldn't even change your face.
That's funny.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.